Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, trends are changing for the so-called land of opportunity. Where in the world is there equality of opportunity? Then, are the high alerts, embassy closures, and the national surveillance state reasonable reactions to the threat of terrorist acts? Finally, what most of the world has gotten wrong about Muslim fundamentalism? The trend for economic equality in the U.S. has been changing, with less opportunity for people to transcend intergenerational economic status than they have in other countries, like Norway, Finland, Denmark, and Canada. Why the changes? Miles Korak is with us. He is a professor of economics at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa. He's the author of Generational Income Mobility in North America and Europe and The Intergenerational Transmission of Employees. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Miles Korak.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things that you have been studying is this gap between the so-called American dream and the reality, particularly with upward mobility. Perhaps what we should start with is that the opportunities for children of the privileged, what you called the 1% in your article, are quite different from everybody else. Maybe we should get a sense of how different they really are and what the primary drivers are.
In one sense, different in the amount of resources these children have, but they're also very different in kind. I think all children benefit from having more monetary resources in the household. But what's happened over the last generation or so in the United States is a very significant increase in the amount of spending that goes to what people have called enrichment expenditures amongst families in the upper end of the income distribution. They're spending a lot more money on things like computers, books, summer camps, extra tutorials, and things of this sort to increase what economists call the human capital of their children. That's just ballooned over the last two or three decades. But it's also the nature of these resources are sort of fundamentally different. It's certainly true that parents help their children at all stages of the important transitions that children go through in becoming adults, not just in the early years, but also through the teen years. And the other thing that really distinguishes the families in the top 1% is the foothold those families are able to give their children in the labor market when the children are in their late teens or early 20s. Everybody relies on networks of some sort to get information about jobs and possible job opportunities. But in the top 1%, you see a very large fraction of children actually being employed by the same employer who employs their father. So in some countries, almost 7 out of 10 kids in the top 1% actually have at some point held a job with an employer that also employed their fathers. Part of that also has to do with, you see this sort of echo in the education system. So children of the relatively well-to-do are on a different educational track through more selective high schools and colleges.
One of the other things that you've done in your work is comparative studies, comparing the United States with other similarly situated countries that are wealthy. How different are they with regards to this phenomenon?
The United States is different in the sense that the degree of inequality is much higher than in other countries, and therefore we see the amount of resources for the top 1% being much higher. So there is a significant difference in just the resources available there. But there are also differences in how those resources end up structuring fundamental institutions like the education system and the healthcare system. So in the U.S., you see a more divergence. For example, if you make a comparison to Canada, children born at the top are much more likely to become adults who are in turn raise the next generation of children at the top. And similarly, if you're born at the bottom, you're much more likely to stay in the bottom in the United States than in Canada. So there are significant differences, and I think part of that has to do with the structure of labor markets as well.
You also looked at, I think it was Denmark and Sweden. How did they compare with the U.S. and Canada?
Well, in terms of mobility, Denmark is probably the most intergenerationally mobile country where family background is very loosely associated with a child's ultimate adult success. But I think we also have to be careful in making comparisons like that. Denmark is a very different country, much smaller, not just geographically, but also much more demographically homogeneous. Some of the comparisons that I did focus on tended to be towards countries like Canada, which are also share a lot in common with the United States. But the other lesson we have from these countries is, you know, inequality has gone up, for example, quite significantly in Sweden and in Canada as well. Not as much as in the United States, but these countries have also seen a rise in the share of income going to the top 1%. Yet somehow in Sweden, for example, even though there's this dynasty amongst the top 1%, the rest of society stays relatively mobile and can still live with that dynasty. The starting point for this study was something that the outgoing chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, Alan Krueger, called the Great Gatsby Curve. That involved a comparison of dozens of countries. We've just focused this discussion on those at the two extremes, the most mobile and the least mobile. The most mobile include not just Sweden and Denmark, but also Finland and Norway. And the least mobile include not just the United States, but also the United Kingdom, Italy, and France. And then there are a bunch of other countries in the middle.
Now, if we were going to draw lessons from what Sweden does, would you say it's a public policy question or a cultural question or a behavioral one or all three?
Well, I think in this discussion, it's important to hold more than one possibility in your mind as you think this through. For me, and for the sort of the economic theories that have informed some of my work, there are three fundamental drivers of a child's future prospects. Clearly, the family is a very important institution, determining how children get a start in life and promoting them throughout their lives. But families also have to mesh with labor markets, and so the structure of labor markets also matter. The more unequal labor markets are, the more unequal wages and access to good jobs are, the less mobility there'll be. And finally, between the family and the labor market is the state and public policy. Public policy can be designed to be progressive in the sense of being of relatively more benefit to the less advantaged, or it could skew things the other way and be of relatively more benefit to the advantaged. So I think we can have different opinions upon which of these institutions are the major drivers. As a labor economist, I tend to see the labor market as being the important driver and that meshes these other gears, the family and public policy. But in the United States, all three of these things, institutions, are configured in a way that leads to less mobility and less opportunity for the less advantaged. Public policy tends to be less progressive. The U.S., for example, spends a good deal of money on education, but it doesn't level the playing field as much as it could. It spends a good deal of money on social policy, but it goes mostly to the elderly, older population. In the U.S., the labor market is much more unequal and much more polarized, and family structures are also more polarized.
The article that you wrote for the New York Times, you opened it with a little vignette about Jan Wenner, who is the publisher of Rolling Stone, as an example of some of these underlying dynamics. Why did you choose Wenner, and then how common is his story to America's story?
It was just one example that happened to have come up more recently. I certainly did not want to pick on him and the fact that his son now runs RollingStone.com. But it's easy to find many examples like that. As I suggested earlier, the use of families and networks is very common across the entire income distribution. But it's particularly notable amongst the rich. And I can find examples of this sort in countries like Australia and Canada and many others. But I think the point of picking up on an anecdote like this is to emphasize that opportunities aren't the same across the income distribution, but also to stress that one important aspect of rising inequality that hasn't been fully appreciated is the degree to which it forms opportunity and the degree to which it'll be passed on to the next generation. If the children of the very well-to-do are also more talented than average and have more skills, as the little anecdote seems to suggest that Mr. Wenner feels is the case, then it doesn't negatively impact on the productivity of the economy. But evidence, in fact, shows that that's, on average, not the case. So this is an example of inequality begetting inequality, not for reasons of productivity, skills, or talent, but because the playing field is not as level as it could be.
The other cultural belief that you think is maybe even holding up this continued dynamic is this belief that people in the U.S. can be upwardly mobile. Do you think this is a myth? And what do you think the costs of that are?
it's a myth, might be going a bit too far. I mean, there is a good deal of mobility in the United States for the broad middle of the income distribution, but it's very sticky at the top. But to the extent that people tend to justify their position in life because of inherent talent and more skills that they have, that sort of forms our attitudes to public policy. If it's all about your own efforts and personal responsibility, then you're less inclined to support public policies to level the playing field, give the disadvantaged a stronger foothold. And the view that my article tries to address is that, that's a very important part of the American dream, that anybody can make it with sufficient energy and talent. And if a very influential part of the population believes that, those in the upper fifth, then they're much more inclined to project that on everybody else and therefore skew or structure public policies in a way that doesn't really promote mobility. In a very real sense, the American dream is still there to be had. That's why many immigrants wish to come to the United States. But what we're talking about here is sort of one's relative position in society, and opportunities are not as fluid as we often think they are as a result.
Do you think that it was once more egalitarian with more opportunities for mobility than it is today? And is that where the belief started?
The idea of American exceptionalism and the American dream has a long history in U.S. discussions. But certainly, at least some studies have found that the degree of intergenerational mobility was much higher a generation or two ago than it is now. As a result, Americans, to the extent that they continue to believe that, would be willing to accept more inequality than many other countries. The point of my article was also to illustrate that that's changed. People who grew up in the 50s and 60s faced a very different family structure, a very different labor market than those growing up in the 80s, 90s, or the early 2000s. I think there's a greater awareness now of that over the last decade or so.
If you were going to design policy from this point forward, drawing from those that are more successful in enabling people to be economically mobile, what would you say the most important ones are?
I think that's a very good question, and there's certainly a lot of discussion about that in the literature. James Heckman of the University of Chicago has pointed our attention to the very important role of the early years. So, for example, the recent proposal to extend kindergarten to four-year-olds, I think, would be a very important policy to pursue. Professor Heckman's highlighted that the return to an extra dollar of investment in the early years is much greater than in the later years. Other things that we could do certainly should be directed to supporting the family, particularly parents with the young children, trying to reduce stress loads in the family, perhaps through more parental leave or options for leave or more flexibility in daycare provisions. And the third set of policies would revolve around trying to develop a more equitable labor market in which lower-skilled jobs aren't paid as poorly as they are now.
Well, Miles Corak, thank you for joining us once again on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Are the high alerts, embassy closures, and the national surveillance state reasonable reactions to the threat of terrorist acts? Our next guest suggests that the government may be overreacting and that the chance of being killed by an act of terrorism is far less than other dangers, such as gun violence. John Mueller is a research scientist and professor of political science at Ohio State University and author of War, Presidents, and Public Opinion. Mark Stewart is a professor of civil engineering and director of the Center for Infrastructure, Performance, and Reliability at the University of Newcastle in Australia. Together, they have co-authored Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, John Mueller, Mark Stewart. You've kind of opened your argument in your book saying that we've really not been asking the right questions. Maybe the right one isn't, are we safer? What do you think it should be, John Mueller?
Yes, it should not be, are we safer, but how safe are we? And that's where you'd really begin. The question is, do you want to spend more money to become even safer than you are now? And virtually no one ever brings up that question. You can calculate pretty easily, and a reasonable estimate is your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million per year if you're an American. And that includes 9/11 in the calculations. So the question, if you start from there, is that safe enough? Now, maybe you'd argue that, no, I won't be safe until it's 1 in 4 million or something, but that's the kind of discussion that should be there, not simply have we improved safety marginally from where it was 10 months ago or 10 years ago.
Mark Stewart.
The next question is, if you're going to spend a lot of money on Homeland Security measures, how much does it actually reduce that risk? So then you have to think about, well, if you can reduce the risk by a certain amount, that gives you a benefit, and does that actually exceed the cost of that measure? And in most cases, we've found that because the existing risk is so low, additional risk reduction actually causes a very small additional benefit. The costs are way, way higher than those potential benefits.
You compared the likelihood of being harmed or killed in a terrorist act versus other potential ways of dying, such as traffic accidents, industrial accidents, natural disasters. Let's break some of those down. John Mueller?
Yes. If your chance of being killed is 1 in 3.5 million, and you could argue that it's actually even lower than that, but if you start with that, you can certainly compare it to, for example, your chance of being killed in an automobile accident in the United States, which is about 1 in 8,000, or 1 chance in 22,000 of being a victim of homicide, or 1 chance in a million of dying by drowning in a bathtub, or 1 chance in about 7 million of being killed by lightning. Now, that's not the end of the discussion, obviously, and a lot of people point out correctly that terrorism has additional ramifications because it terrifies people and causes disruptions in the economy and anxiety more than some of those other hazards. So that should definitely be considered, but that's a good place to start. What is your chance of being killed, and do you really want to spend money on making it less likely that an American will be killed by terrorism when the chances now are 1 in 3.5 million, or, say, improving cancer research, or putting in smoke alarms, or reducing the dangers of driving on the highways.
Or gun violence.
Yes, definitely.
Mark Stewart?
So the risk assessment methods that we're actually using are nothing new. I mean, they've been applied to a whole range of existing hazards, going from nuclear power to hurricane protection to flood protection to pharmaceuticals to EPA regulations. So all we're really asking is that that same degree of scientific rigor gets applied to the hazard of terrorism.
Some of those hazards that Mark mentioned are very politically dicey. For example, in particular, nuclear radiation. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to very much consider that. It's not simply what the damage might be, but the emotional impact, etc. So regulators have for decades been dealing with these kinds of situations, both hazards that don't carry a huge emotional impact as well as ones that do.
Now, is the risk so low with regards to a terrorist attack because so much money is spent?
No, I don't think so. It certainly contributes. And obviously, you can start by saying, well, this is where it is now with the amount of spending we've been doing. And the question is, do you want to spend even more to make it even lower? Or if we relax some of the strictures that have been put in, it may increase the likelihood you'd be killed by a terrorist a little bit. But with that money, we could spend it on other hazards which have far more lethal. It's not terribly clear. You know, 9/11 is standing out as this extreme aberration. It has not been a harbinger. And the various people have been caught and detained and have been incapable of creating remotely that kind of violence. So consequently, it's not obvious that the measures that have been put in place have stopped a huge number of 9/11s or things that are even worse.
Particularly, many of these measures took 2 or 3 years to actually implement after 9/11, and there were no attacks immediately following 9/11. So you could almost argue that maybe the threat isn't as high as we think it was.
So let's talk about how much money we actually do spend. You've calculated some of that. Where do we spend it, and how much do we spend it to battle terrorism?
We looked at direct federal government expenditures, state and local government expenditures. And these come out to something like more than $700 billion since 9/11. And then if you start to include some of the opportunity costs, such as the fact that if you make flying difficult for passengers, it becomes actually not a particularly pleasant experience by having long queues at the screening channels and all sorts of other issues, then if you actually divert people to driving to the destination rather than flying, then that actually costs lives, because flying is much, much more safer than most other forms of transportation. So any security measure that actually deters people from using a safer mode of transport actually is costing lives rather than saving lives. So when you tally all of that in, the total cost exceeds more than $1 trillion since 9/11. And then if you include the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's another $1 trillion. So we're talking about serious amounts of money.
Let me add also, that is the increase since 9/11, not the total expenditures.
And then, of course, we've seen cutbacks in other programs and a lot of budget fights lately. How does this fit in with the politics that's going on right now in Congress?
Since budgets are not infinite, you have to make choices. The politicians and bureaucrats are to have to do that all the time. And so consequently, it seems to be their profound responsibility when you're dealing here with public safety, which is the foundational reason for government to begin with, that that money should be spent in a way which improves public safety for the maximum amount, given how much money you have to spend. So to do it emotionally or to do it in a way that is extremely and absurdly risk-averse means that basically you're spending money that doesn't save very many lives when you could spend that same money that would improve public safety considerably more. But as far as we can see, that kind of calculation, which is extremely basic and straightforward and simple, is not really put into place when you get into this area.
Just to follow on John's question, the other thing that's a concern is the expenditure is still increasing. It shows no sign of trying to level off. So the issue is, you know, where do you draw the line? And when we compare the expenditures to the UK, Australia and Canada, US expenditures probably 2 to 4 times higher on a per capita basis or per GDP basis or any other standard metric. So the US expenditures really stands out compared to what other countries are doing.
And what is it that you see that it's primarily being spent on? I saw some of the things in your books about every time a container comes through customs, there's just all this extra process. But what would you say the top anti-terrorist expenses are?
Probably the biggest single lump of money goes towards the Transportation Security Administration, and that's really aimed at the aviation security. And if I had to pick something from aviation security, it would be the Federal Air Marshal Service. This is the service that has about 3,000 to 4,000 air marshals. And the intent of these is to sit on aircraft and to try to stop potential terrorists accessing the cockpit door to stop a repeat of the 9/11 attacks. And 3,000 to 4,000 air marshals sounds like a lot of air marshals, but there's something like 60,000 flights a day in the United States. So they only cover probably no more than 5 to 10% of flights, and that's both domestic and international. They cost more than $1.2 billion a year. So it's a very expensive service. Since they hardened the cockpit doors, you know, very soon after 9/11, that really closed the vulnerability. And in the last 11 or 12 years, the air marshals actually have done nothing. There hasn't been a single terrorist incident that they can claim to have averted. Other countries don't have air marshal services. Australia has actually cut back on its number, and there's a large number of European countries who actually never even had them. So that's probably one of the specific items of expenditure which we think is heavily excessive.
The $1.2 billion they're spent on the air marshals is about the same budget as the entire Los Angeles police force. Another way of looking at this is that after 9/11, in a state of panic, a huge amount of money was thrown at this problem. Now, that's perfectly understandable. We all remember the atmosphere after 9/11. The most basic kind of common sense is that when you spend a lot of money in haste, whether it's government or business or personal, you're likely to misspend a fair amount of that money. After a few years, one would think, you'd want to go back and revisit those expenditures. Some of them, maybe just out of pure luck, proved to be really quite cost-effective and really valuable in reducing the risk at a reasonable cost. Others surely have been wasteful, because they've been so hastily put together and so under-considered. So what we've been trying to do is to do exactly that, and I must say quite surprised at in many respects, is that no one has done this really systematically, including the Department of Homeland Security. It's 12 years now. After 2 or 3 years, you'd think, well, we should do a stock-taking. Or maybe after the administration changes and you say, okay, we've been through this thing for 7, 8 years now, it's not time to see if this is really sensibly put together. But as far as we can see, that hasn't been done.
With the revelations of the NSA and Edward Snowden, I'm assuming these would be even extra costs that you didn't get into your calculations.
They're somewhat in there. About 45% of the increased expenditures have been on protection, like TSA and putting border guards and putting up bollards around airports and so forth. And another 45% has been on increased policing and intelligence. Our book mostly deals with the former, the protection measures. You know, does it make sense to try to fortify a building against a terrorist attack? And a lesser amount in the book, the Terror Security and Money book, deals with policing. But we're now beginning to look at that as well to see if the FBI, for example, and their $3 billion they spend on counterterrorism, whether that's cost-effective or not.
Now, I was also struck by how much fear people still felt and concern about terrorist attacks years after 9/11. And some of that, you said, is a result of, it's a kind of a new coining of a term, the terrorism industry. How would you characterize this?
That's my phrase there. What happens is you have people very much afraid of something, and then you have a lot of people who see, hey, there's gold in those hills. And so you have basically politicians, bureaucrats, and people selling things to the government realize that there's this need, this fear out there that they can basically service and do well at, and the media, by the way. So there's a tendency to exacerbate the threat. If you're going to sell x-ray machines to the government and you find the government really is desperately suddenly in need of x-ray machines, you pussyfoot it quickly over to Washington. And when you get there, you don't say you don't really need these x-ray machines. Instead, you're likely to sort of exacerbate the threat. In terms of the public opinion, however, and that's the driving factor on this in many respects, I think, it is impressive, as you mentioned initially, that the fears of terrorism do not seem to have subsided much since the end of 2001. For example, when asked on polls at the end of 2001 whether they were worried that they or a family member might be a victim of terrorism, about 40% said yes. That number still is pretty much at that same level, even after the death of bin Laden and even 12 years later. So I don't think necessarily the terrorism industry has created this perception, but they certainly have an incentive to exacerbate it and to work with it.
Mark Stewart?
There's also no reason to, in a sense, to link public opinion to what the actual expenditures are. In the Australian experience, we had our Prime Minister at the time was John Howard, and he was a very close ally to George Bush and the US.
In Australia?
In Australia. And his rhetoric was extremely strong. I think George Bush labelled him the man of steel and all those sort of very strong statements. And the Australian public liked that. And he was also very successful politically. But the spending did not match the rhetoric. And that's the thing. You can still be strong on terrorism, have strong statements, have a lot of public support, obviously spend some money, you know, to close some of the important vulnerabilities. But you can still be successful politically. So I think what the US stands out amongst other countries is how the spending has almost exceeded the rhetoric.
Another way of looking at that is that although the public is definitely saying, I want to be safe or safer or whatever, it doesn't follow that they're saying, we want to take off our shoes before you get into airplanes. We want to have air marshals on a large number of flights and so forth. So even though there is this concern out there, it does not mean that politicians have to spend $1 trillion. And as Mark suggests, that other countries have also felt pressure. They have spent more money, definitely, but not nearly as much proportionally as the United States, and those politicians are still in office. So the argument that the bureaucrats and politicians frequently make is we have to do this because, you know, otherwise we'd be thrown out of office, it simply doesn't bear up under that experience.
When you look at the budget fights that are going on now, it would seem that they would stop and think logically about how much we really need to spend to have that little bit more safety. But it really speaks also to the power of fear, how debilitating fear can be, and the behavioral consequences. John Mueller?
Yes, they can. If you've got 40% of the people worrying, if your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million, the idea that you worry about it at all is pretty absurd. But no one is ever saying this. One politician once said something like this. It was Mayor Bloomberg in 2007. And that's where the discussion should begin. And I suppose from the bureaucratic standpoint, the problem is if you say, well, your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million per year, you're afraid that the answer will then be, well, then how come we're giving you so much money? The important thing is to spend the money in a manner that maximizes public safety, not simply to preserve your job or your department.
Our experience has been is that the public actually gets it. They can see the risk of terrorism compared to other hazards. They can see that the spending seems out of whack of what the actual risks actually are. So once you actually go through and explain the process and put data and numbers to this and compare risks to other hazards, it doesn't come across as controversial at all.
Thank you so much for being with us, John Mueller. Mark Stewart, it's great to have you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
When we come back, what most of the world has gotten wrong about Muslim fundamentalism. Stay tuned.
Uh, أول إشي لازم نمتلكه هي المبادرة اسمعي فهم استطلت تقدر تناديها محاضرة احنا في مصارع اللي من زمان ثبتونا فيها بينادوها مامرة وعدم وعلي خليها أعرفكم أنا بس أنا من بلد اسمها اللي فيها اللي بوتها ما بدفع التمن وفيها اللي بهدلل ناس اللي عملوا غلطوا بنوا عرضهم وكل اللي بيصير بس عشانهم لوحدهم غير واقف على موقف اللي شرف ودير إلي أقول ويبدأ فهم إنه القوة بالمجمع ولا مرة بالمفردة وعادة إذا فكرنا هيك إحنا بمفرد عن الكل والغلط إنه فكرنا بالكل بس هذا الغلط لأنه صح ولازم ودوم ولما قلنا إيدي بإيد ما كانش قصنا أصبع ولا تأخذ لازم تطلب والقوة بالمجمع
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In many parts of the world, fundamentalism is on the rise, oppressing human rights, sometimes using bodily harm and even death. Simultaneously, the international community has been ineffective in helping the scholars, journalists, human rights advocates, and artists who are struggling against the oppression. How bad is the situation and what can be done? Three experts join us. Karima Banoon is a professor of law at the University of California, Davis School of Law. She is the author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. Husseina Alidu is a professor and the director of the Center for African Studies at Rutgers University. She is the author of Engaging Modernity, Muslim Women and the Politics of Agency in Postcolonial Niger, and Women, Gender, and Freedom of Expression, Sub-Saharan Africa. Sadia Abbas is professor of English in the program in Women and Gender Studies at Rutgers University. Her publications include the forthcoming At Freedom's Limit, Islam and the Postcolonial Predicament. She has also authored The Echo Chamber of Freedom, The Muslim Women and the Pretext of Agency. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Karima Banoon, I would like to start with how you open your book, which is your own experience in Algeria during a time when religious fundamentalists were killing scholars, journalists, trade unionists, others. You had a personal experience with your father. What happened?
Yes, I always say that I did not come to this subject by choice. It's really a topic that came to me. So the book opens in 1993, which was a time of increasing assassinations in Algeria of intellectuals by the armed fundamentalist groups that were battling the state. As one local newspaper described it, every Tuesday, and specifically every Tuesday morning, a researcher fell to the bullets of the fundamentalists. So one Tuesday morning, a week after the killing of a colleague of my father's in front of his own daughter, somebody showed up at our house early in the morning and was pounding on the door, would not go away. We couldn't figure out who it was. My father tried to get the police on the phone, and the local police, I think perhaps partly because of all the attacks on police officers, they themselves did not answer. And we were left there to face whoever was on the other side of the door. Now, we were lucky that day. Whoever it was went away. But somebody would come back soon after and leave a note on the kitchen table that said, consider yourself dead, and they would write death to on the mailbox in front of our name. And as I say in the book, the world looks different once you've seen death to before your name.
You also noted in your book that in many parts of the world, fundamentalism is rising and getting worse.
So the project of the book really was to go out and find the people today who are doing the work that my father was doing back in the 1990s and to try to bring them some of the attention and international solidarity that my father and his colleagues did not receive at that time. So I actually set out and interviewed close to 300 people of Muslim heritage from nearly 30 countries, from Afghanistan to Mali. And what was really striking, given the diversity of the context, I mean, I visited diaspora populations in Europe. I went as far as Fiji. I was in Egypt and Tunisia. What I heard almost everywhere was that this was a growing problem that people were increasingly worried about. And so my hope really in the book is to tell some of their stories and to really try to bring them some transnational support, because their opponents certainly have transnational support, that funding that comes from outside and so on. So that's what the book is really about. It's also about trying to challenge some of the discriminatory ideas about Muslims and people of Muslim heritage in the West by showing their tremendous diversity and by really answering that question that we've all heard so many times, where are the Muslims that speak out? How come no Muslims speak out? Well, in fact, they do. they're just not always the ones with the microphone, and I'm trying to change that at least a little bit.
Let's talk about some of the people that you interviewed. You found some, what I would say, common themes. What would you say the most common themes are across the people that you interviewed?
Well, I would say one thing that I heard about from people, whether it was in Pakistan or whether it was in Niger, was a sense of not having the space to express oneself, not having the space to do this work, and the real need to create the spaces in which these kinds of views can be heard and these sorts of people can have their activities. And there was a very interesting example that I came across in Karachi in Pakistan of somebody actually opening a cultural center called T2F in a cafe precisely to try to create a space for people through artistic expression, through lectures and so on, to be able to come together and face off against the fundamentalists. Another common theme that I found across the regions was the sense that women were target number one of the fundamentalist groups. And in fact, a colleague of Professor Ali Duz, Zainabu Hadari, said to me, she said, every step forward in the struggle for women's rights is a step forward in the struggle against fundamentalism. And I think that that's absolutely true. And it's no accident that the chapter about women's rights defenders is the longest chapter in my book.
Some of the experiences were quite harrowing. For example, in Mali, you had the experience of the activists who had their limbs cut off and were beaten publicly for something as simple as wearing the wrong veil. How prevalent is this?
Abuses that you're referencing occurred in Mali in 2012 when the northern half of that country was occupied by jihadist armed groups. And the thing that really stays with me are the people who were challenging those who were carrying out amputations and floggings and so on. And I interviewed an amazing school teacher who I call in the book Mr. Bodmar for his safety. That's what he asked me to call him. And he was keeping his school open in Gao, his hometown, that was occupied by Mujahideen, which is one of the armed groups allied to Al-Qaeda. And he would continue to educate boys and girls together in his classroom and remain there, even though it was very dangerous. But he said that this gave hope to his students, and he couldn't take their hope away from them. And then, and this is where the amputations piece of the story comes in, he did this incredibly courageous thing, which is that he would force himself to go and witness every use of corporal punishment by the local jihadists. So every time that they would amputate hands or feet of people accused of theft, or they would flog people in public because of dress and so on, when this was announced ahead of time, he would go to witness so that he could try to assist the victims afterwards, and so he could try to document what was happening in his home city. And he was really haunted by this, but he forced himself to keep going, to sort of write the history of his hometown. And now the jihadist occupation of Gao has ended, although there's a great deal of concern that when the international troops that chased the jihadists out leave, which is to happen shortly, they may in fact return. So these practices are not continuing at the moment in northern Mali, but the fear is that they would start all over again. And in fact, it goes back to your earlier question, this issue of threatening to use these kinds of corporal punishments. This was something else that I ran into in many different contexts. In some places, it may only be rhetoric. In some places, there may be only a few instances. And in some places, you know, we see, such as in Iran, the use of some of these practices becomes very widespread.
Hossaina Alidu, let's bring you in. You have been looking at these issues related to women in Kenya and Niger. How have their experiences compared with the experiences that Karima Benoun has found in her book, Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here?
Thank you very much for inviting me. And congratulations, Karima, for this book. Yes, there are convergence in terms of Karima's findings and also my work in Niger and East Africa. So for me, starting from Niger, a predominantly Muslim country, and I'm from Niger too, I went back to Niger in the 90s to do my doctoral research on a totally different topic. But what was surprising to me as somebody coming from Niger is the way in which the landscape has changed, with all of the sudden Islamism marking itself on people's bodies, something that I have not experienced as a Muslim person growing up in Niger. And here is a Muslim person who was raised in a Christian school, because the Muslims trusted that their children will be well-raised, and they trusted Christians, because I attended a Catholic school from kindergarten to the end of high school. And the majority of the students, I went to all-girls school, were from Muslim communities. And we were not forced, either by the Muslims or by the Christians, to make religion as a way of marking our life or our space, in a way of differentiating or discriminating against somebody. So here in the 90s, all of a sudden you see this bodily presentation by the way that Islamism is marking itself and insisting on how now women, actually both women and men, should look like. So from there, it creates what I'm calling a different tradition, and a tradition which invites violence, because it's either you cover yourself in a way that is required by the new way of marking your piety, or you are not a proper Muslim. I grew up, and many of my friends, and they continue up to today, wearing pants, skirts, and you dress whatever you want. And if you know West Africa, we like to dress, and we like to show up the hair design on all sorts. But all of a sudden, with this new way of being Muslim, all that have changed. So I thought, as a linguist, I have to finish my research, but come back to write this new story about women and the implication that it will have in terms of the violence, in terms of bodily integrity, but also the psychological violence. And I saw it was gendered in the sense that even with men, now men also have been required, through this adherence of these new ways of being Muslim in a fundamentalist way, of appearing physically. You have to wear beard, you have to wear pants that are shortened, and the fashions, the diversity of male fashion that existed in the Sahelian landscape began to be also questioned. And girls going to school, there are some schools where they're required to wear skirts or to wear uniform. If it is not the type of things that this new fundamentalist Muslim wanted, then the girls are aggressed in the streets. And that led to a march of the women in Niger to say, no, you cannot aggress our daughters and you cannot aggress us. In my work, I try to show the difference, because we also have to be careful in the different nuances and the use of language of expressing what it is that is happening. A Muslim society, just like other societies, had both liberal and conservative. And within that, that does not make them fundamentalists. What is the problem here is the violence, the insistence that there is only one way of existing. And I observed that in Niger, and I studied that in Kenya. And I thought it's important to bring the typology of those structures that exist, and how fundamentalism is actually very, very different from the old tradition of ways of being Muslim for both women and men. And then how it is really very dangerous if it is not addressed. And then fundamentalism of Muslims also calls, is very similar to the kind of reactive things, because if you are in predominantly Muslim society like Niger, you have Islamic fundamentalism, it produces a reactive responses of producing Christian fundamentalism, which has a negative consequences for minority Christian women in a predominantly Muslim society. My research in Kenya shows that there is a fundamentalism of Christian in East Africa, places like Kenya and Uganda, and it produces the other side of a conversation, and sometimes they marry each other with Islamic fundamentalism. And this is very dangerous, and we have to do something about it.
I wanted to kind of get clarity on a couple of items. I think I heard you say other side.
Yes.
And you mean by other side?
Religion in Africa. I want to use an expression that a colleague called Dora King has used, that religion in Africa is a marketplace, you see? So what is happening is, now that I have done both research in predominantly Muslim societies in Africa, like in Niger, where I come from, and in minority Muslim country like Kenya, when you have fundamentalism of Islam is a bedfellow to fundamentalism of other faiths. So I give you one example. As Islamic fundamentalism is rising in Niger, it produces a type of fundamentalism that people are not watching. That has a problem for the women of Niger who are of non-Muslim background because it's reactive to Islamic fundamentalism. So you have Christian fundamentalism through Pentecostal churches responding. And at times also they are on the same platform on issues like abortion or gay rights. Both Muslim fundamentalism and Christian and also traditionalist other monotheistic religion will come to be together. You see?
Yes. One of the things you said is by marking the bodies, which it sounded like you were talking about the dress code, you said it invites violence.
Yes. It is a form of first, if they do not take arm literally, I think it is a form of violence. I should not be forced to be dressed certain way in whatever context, especially through the use of religion, which will also create a condition where a fatwa would be issued that if you do not dress certain way, that there is a right for those people who want to aggress you to force you to come to the right path by dressing the way they want. In West Africa, we wear bubus, which are beautiful designs, traditionally conceived within West African aesthetics. I don't see why I have to be forced to be dressed like somebody who is coming from Saudi Arabia or from South Asia or Iran, if it is not what I decided by choice to be my fashion.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about what most of the world has gotten wrong about Muslim fundamentalism. Let's bring Sadia Abbas in. Sadia Abbas, first of all, there's something that you also wrote that speaks to this struggle also from the pressure of the West. You used the phrase freeing themselves from freedom. What did you mean?
Thank you. Could I respond first?
Oh, please.
Answer your question?
Yeah.
Just because I'm sort of, you know, thinking with everyone here, which is one of the points that Sana made, and I think that Karima has, even in her example from Karachi, which is where I grew up, in, by the way, a profoundly conservative family. And my father is an Islamist, and I say this only because he's also one of the only members of the family I can talk to, right? So we fight, but we also talk. And many of my thoughts are formed sort of in a kind of, you know, kind of heated dialogue with him. And I think that's important because despite everything, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s in Pakistan, Pakistan was a very different place. And I think that's a theme that you'll hear from, you've already heard from the other two people here, which is that it was, you know, about forms of self-expression were different, forms of address were different. And by different, I don't mean that everybody has started, you know, dressing differently now. I mean that there was less pressure to conform to a perceived monolithic religious identity. And that started changing in the mid-1980s. One of the things that Asana said, I think, is very important. What I've argued in my own forthcoming book is that this modern form of Islam is fundamentally anti-customary, that it is anti-cultural, it's anti-customary, and it goes against all kinds of, you know, lived forms of Islam. The pressure here is complicated because, as I'm sure you know, Pakistan became the place that it is. I mean, its religious identity became as exacerbated as it did under Zia-ul-Haq, the military dictator who ruled from 1977 to 1988, who had massive American support. So what happened in Pakistan could not have happened without large amounts of funding from the United States and the Cold War. It would have been impossible. The irony of the current moment is also that as those alliances have imploded, and the Islamists now have the identity of being anti-imperialists and anti-West, right? And, of course, way back, I mean, or even, but it's not so far back, but about 20 years ago, they were seen as the allies of the Americans. It was the left in Pakistan that accused them of being imperial allies. So one of the things that's happened now, and there's a kind of weird symbiosis between the international left and what's going on in the ground and the conservative sections in many parts of the Muslim world, is that because George Bush used the language of freedom, right, to quote-unquote liberate many parts of the Muslim world, what's happened is that but a conservative Islam has been produced or is now perceived as being somehow constitutively anti-freedom, that we do not want Western-style freedom is something that people will repeatedly say, and the Islam that is perceived as the other of Western-style freedom, in fact, conservative modern fundamentalism. So many young people will sign on to that version of Islam because they want to, and that's the paradox that I play with throughout my book, free ourselves from freedom. What does that mean? It just means that it's a kind of anti-imperialism that accepts, ironically, a certain segment of the West's presentation of itself. And my argument is that that's not something we should believe historically anyway.
Karima Banoon, let's bring you back in then, because I think one of the arguments of your book is that the international community has largely failed these human rights movements, whether they are peace movements or women's movement. If you're going to say how they've failed and how they might correct that failure, what would you say?
Well, one of my frustrations is that currently in the West, we see that there seem to be largely two available discourses. Some on the right, which are openly discriminatory, that suggest that sort of all Muslims are fundamentalist or Islam is inherently fundamentalist, and that's clearly offensive and wrong. But then we also see, unfortunately, sometimes on the left, and Professor Abbas referred to this, we see in the West, on the left, a certain political correctness that makes people silent about these issues, or even sometimes in the worst case scenario, sympathetic to the fundamentalists who are cast in the role of being anti-imperialist. And what I'm arguing is that both of these sets of discourses that we encounter are insufficient, are inaccurate, are inappropriate responses, and they actually undercut the people on the ground who are doing this work. And so what we need to do is to actually start listening to them about how they perceive the threats from fundamentalism in their contexts and what kind of solidarity would be important. And I was really struck by what a Malian woman lawyer said to me about how hard it is to do this kind of work, you know, by yourself. And so a big part of what I'm doing is trying to break that wall of isolation. I think there's a range of ways the international community can support these people. I mean, one of the first things, obviously, is not to support fundamentalists in the first place, whether they are fundamentalist governments like the Islamizing dictatorship of Zia al-Haq, to which Professor Abbas alluded, or whether they are non-state movements like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan that we supported in the U.S., supported the most extreme of the Mujahideen, regardless of their ideology, because they were fighting against the Soviet Union. And that has had terrible, lasting consequences, both for the Afghan population, but also for the populations in other countries, because many young jihadis came and got their training there and then took that training home with them. So that's the first thing, not to support fundamentalists. Then, secondly, to find creative ways to support those who are standing up for equality and tolerance and real substantive democracy, whether it is through finding ways to help fund their projects, whether it is bringing them to the U.S. to actually speak, whether they speak English or not, so that we get to hear from them, whether it's translating what is being written in Urdu, in Arabic, in French, in so many other languages about these issues. I think it's absolutely critical that we find a new response. And I wanted to respond to something that Professor Alidu said, because I thought it was very well put what she said about this new way of being Muslim. I think people have to understand this. What we're talking about here in regards to fundamentalism are political movements of the extreme right. This is the definition I cite in my book. So these are political movements that are exploiting religion, that are using religion for political purposes. And I think that really has to be understood. This is not a conservative project about protecting tradition. This is, in fact, about radically changing the way that people live their lives in many different Muslim-majority contexts. And many people of Muslim heritage are standing up and saying, this is not the kind of change that we want.
Usaina Alidu, how would you say the West should respond?
I think it's important to look at the place of women as the key agent of social changes, democratic social changes that are taking place from grassroots all the way to all different instances of society. Most of the time, what I think that when people speak of societies, it's always from the point of view of a segment. So the representation that we get, the voices that we get of who are these leaders of Muslim societies, the discourse is always focusing on the fundamentalism. So it's giving them a more platform. And yet there are women and men who are challenging that, but who are not being given the proper platform to address issues about societies and the right of groups and individuals to exist, and also to be empowered. If the West want to do development projects, why is it that those other segments, the multiplicity of alternative ways of living in a peaceful way, respectful way, and tolerant way, are not addressed? That's, to me, where we have to have a conversation and to see the central role that women play in society.
Sadia Abbas?
Two things. One is start listening, which we haven't done, and that would involve, and the we is complicated here because I live here and I've lived there and I go back and forth, but that can only happen if we give up certain assumptions, one of which is that Muslims are not free of ideology, like any other group. You know, there's a whole variety of them, and that's why Karima's book is so important, because she has, tried to listen to other people as well, right? Not the ones who get standardly kind of hyper-visibilized because they happen to be the figures who are, fit the model of Western security, right, or terrorology, as somebody I know calls it. So, you know, we listen to these fundamentalists or the Islamists because those are the ones who seem most intriguingly different, but they also sort of fit the discourse of security. And the other thing is to not assume that, you know, political and religious identities are seamless and that they fit together tightly in the Muslim world in the way that they don't, or in within Muslim majority societies or Muslim communities in the way that nobody assumes they do here in the West, right? And again, that's complicated because they're Muslims here. So kind of vision of this lump of people out there who apparently all are so similar that we can listen to one particular group and they're going to represent everything that Islam can produce through that. And that, I think, is constituted by a certain Islamophobia, right? Because it's assumed that Islam can only produce reactionary thinking. And then because that is taken to represent Islam, that's the only people that we listen to. And that's both fundamentally disrespectful to a good many people in the world. It's also not accurate.
Thank you for being with us, Hoseina Alidu and Sadia Abbas, Karima Benoun. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Karima Benoun is a professor of law at the University of California, Davis School of Law. She is the author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. Hoseina Alidu is a professor and the director of the Center for African Studies at Rutgers University. She is the author of Engaging Modernity, Muslim Women and the Politics of Agency in Postcolonial Niger, and Women, Gender, and Freedom of Expression, Sub-Saharan Africa. Sadia Abbas is professor of English in the program in Women and Gender Studies at Rutgers University. Her publications include the forthcoming At Freedom's Limit, Islam and the Postcolonial Predicament. She has also authored The Echo Chamber of Freedom, The Muslim Women and the Pretext of Agency. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Kwatema Kailaman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week. نسيها